evictions. Again, there's some great concerns, and that's one of them, that the tenants have no longer the possibility to apply for an extension of time to pay the rent. So if I lose my job, but I found a new job, I know in 1 week I have that money, but I just don't have it right now, I cannot apply for an extension anymore. I can only apply basically for, I can apply still, but I can only apply to prove that I actually need paid the rent. So that's a difference. A landlord can now evict for illegal activity if they are likely to cause, and I'm saying likely, to cause damage or effects of safety of other tenants of the landlord. So under current law, yes, a landlord can also evict tenants if they are causing damage and if they are, you know, putting other people in danger, other tenants in danger, or disturbing them. But it's not for likely. That's a big difference. So, for example, a woman who has a lot of boyfriends, landlord doesn't like it. Well, it would be easy kind of to make up a little story and saying, well, she has lots of boyfriends. Maybe there are going to be some fights, and therefore it's a likeliness there could be some danger to other tenants or their landlord's property. Eviction notice could be issued. Again, so that's a concern we have. Somebody who smokes marijuana in that place. That's an illegal activity, but it doesn't. If it's not disturbing anybody else, it still can be a reason for eviction. So it's something we have great concerns about. It could be used by landlords. That's what we meant with erosion of the tenants' rights. And questions?
How would they determine whether or not it was illegal? Wouldn't you have to be convicted in a court of law?
No, it's. It's likely. It's the basically if you are suspecting, or yet there's the likeliness of cause. It's not so much the illegal activity. Well, the illegal activity is one thing, but it's also the likeliness of cause.
Just to follow up on Sylvia's explanation, if you go to the answers at the end where they were debating this section, one of the questions that Jenny asked Rich Coleman was, you know, now you are saying that a landlord can give a tenant an eviction notice because the landlord suspects that this tenant is doing some illegal activities or doing something that will put the landlord's safety and other tenants in jeopardy. And he said, well, if the landlord suspects that the tenant is engaged in illegal activity, the landlord can go to the residential tenancy office and apply for an early termination. And if the tenant is not engaged in this illegal activity, well, the tenant will have to prove. So that was his answer. And you can read that in the answers. Yeah.
Now, there's something additional at this point. Right now, if a landlord, under the current act, how it's right now, if a landlord evicts a tenant but has not applied for a possession order at the same time, they have to go back and reapply. Now, with the new Bill 70, basically, at the time of the hearing, and a landlord could make a verbal request from the arbitrator to get a possession order at the same time. So if they know the hearing is not going well, it's going in their favor, they can at that point say verbally, I want to have a possession order at the same time.
Does the possession order cost them money?
No, it won't cost the possession order, that won't cost money in this case because they don't have to reapply. Well, to enforce it in the end, that would be a different matter. The landlord, if they evict right now a tenant because they want to move in themselves or their family members, whatever, they have to now pay compensation up to basically 1 month's rent. They have to give us compensation. And the tenant actually can request that he gets 1 month, like basically the 1 month instead of compensation paid out, that they just can stay there for 1 month for free. So it's either way. So that's a good thing because before they didn't get anything. Now for sure they get something. And it's always 1 month. Basically, these are only the changes we're highlighting right now. We're not going through the whole act. These are just a summary of the changes, and I'm not every single detail we mentioned here. It's just kind of an overview of the most drastic things. So if I don't say anything, it pretty much stays the same. Move out. Again, The tenant has to now vacate the apartment by 1 o'clock, the last day of the rental period. So if you register on the 1st, they have to move out on the 31st or the 30th by 1 o'clock. So that leaves them out where? On the street until next day, because they most likely won't be able to move into the new apartment until the 1st. So something we have suggested, instead of 1 o'clock on the last day, put it on the 1st day, and then everybody will be happy and fine. Wonderful. Anyway, but that's not what it is. Landlord and tenants, they must do, again, the move-out inspection. Again, if the tenant is not showing up, the two times the landlord tells the tenant to come and do the inspection report, and the landlord sets the time, by the way, basically they're fortifying their security deposit. The landlord has to provide, again, a copy of the inspection report within 7 days.
Does the landlord, what does the landlord have to do to prove that he gave notice for these two meetings? Does it have to be through registered mail, or what does the landlord have to provide to prove that he gave notice for two meetings that the tenant didn't show up to?
Well, it's supposed to be, like I said, the landlord needs to suggest two times where they can agree on. There's nothing right now in Bill 70, so the regulations will be more specific.
Because right now the landlord could just say, I said,
3 o'clock
I put
the
out
morning.
These two times, he didn't show, too bad for him.
Yeah, so that it's again in the regulations. I think what altogether what we see here is witnesses, proof, all these things will come more and more into, it's just becoming more and more important, to, especially for a tenant to protect themselves, to have witnesses with them whenever they deal, have dealings with the landlord, or put things in writing and keep copies. Again, if the landlord fails or the tenant fails due to the moving or move-out inspection, they lose the right for the deposit, which could be good to some extent. Deposits. Return. Stays the same, 15 days, but now there's a little bit more enforcement about it. If the landlord is not making a claim against the security deposit within the 15 days, they lose their right, or return it, of course. They lose the right to make their claim. Now, on top of it, if the landlord has not returned the deposit or make a claim within the 15 days, they're actually, the tenant is now entitled to double the amount of the deposit, which sounds great. But we'll see then with the enforcement how that works, you know, how to chase after the money. The only good things maybe if it's maybe easier to collect through a collection agency if you have instead of $300, $600. So that's maybe, I don't know. We'll see. We'll see. Arbitration stays pretty much the same. The only thing what is right now, again, in Bill 70 exactly, or what is stated in the 70, that the arbitrators must consider the interpretation and policy guidelines, where before they were just, they were there, but they didn't have to really. So right now it's a little bit more specific. Maybe that could make a little bit of difference for having a little bit more, you know, unique, kind of more consistency of arbitrators' decisions. We'll see. And arbitrators are now encouraged to assist parties to settle their dispute. But the government has been very clear to us, it has nothing, not mediation, so they don't expect the arbitrators to go into mediation. So whatever that means, we kind of, we'll see. We'll see probably in the regulations again, and interpretation guideline will be more specific. Any more questions?
What section is it that deals with that business about being able to accumulate the rent for, you know, the 3 years? And then the business about the CPI increase.
Oh, the rent increase you're talking about. Okay. Section for the rent increase.
A lot of this, you got to remember, the Act, I'm just going to look it up, I can't remember exactly. The Act says the landlord may increase the rent in keeping with the regulations or something like that.
Yes.
So then you go to the regulations, and the reason we know a lot of this is if you go to the very back of Bill 70, there are explanatory notes. And so some of it's in the explanatory notes, and the other place you can go is the government press release. And some of the specifics are included in that, and you can find that on the government website.
That's good, because I've been looking.
Yeah. And that's why we mean that a lot of this is going to be so dependent on the regulations. So we don't see our job as being done in terms of, you know, fighting to strengthen? I mean, if the Act, all it says is that the landlord can increase the rent in compliance with the regulations, well, we still have the opportunity to influence what those regulations are going to be like. And so we plan on doing that and working with all of you, hopefully, to do that as well. Throughout the Act, there are some positives and negatives, but I think this is the actual really very concerning part, because the rent protection provisions now automatically allow a landlord an increase every year of minimum 6 or 7% right now. Again, what other business do you get an automatic increase like that? And as Sadia said, a landlord could go to arbitration and argue that they're falling behind the market and therefore they have to increase the rent 10%. And they may be able to get that. We just don't know yet what that's going to look like. And then there's the catch-up piece. And the fact that the tenant can't dispute it, even if the landlord's not upholding their end of the deal by doing repairs or, you know, following the spirit of the Act. So this section, there's all sorts of sections that we're really concerned about, but this one's going to have the most direct impact on every single tenant in BC.
You had a question from there?
Yeah, my question is around the filing fees and the ability to apply to waive the filing fees. And I think in the service plan summary way back when, a comment was that they're looking at eliminating that. And then they subsequently put out some guidelines for when they'll accept the application to waive the filing fees. Is there any indication that they're going to come down with not allowing that to happen, the $50 filing fee being waived?
What they did is they didn't eliminate the fee. It's a fee waiver, so that when somebody on a fixed or low income can go in and ask for the filing fee of $50 when you're applying for arbitration to be waived. And what they did is they have put guidelines around that which restricts how that can be applied. And again, that's on our website. But I think Sylvia and Sadia can both provide examples of where we're finding. One of the goals of the government is to reduce costs. And so one of the things that they're trying to do is reduce the number of arbitration hearings. So what we're finding is that tenants are having more situations where they're being told, you don't really have a case, so we're not going to let you file. Or, no, sorry, we're not going to let you have a fee waiver, therefore they're not able to file. Mm-hmm. So that's of concern as well. And, you know, that's sort of what we wanted to also raise, is that, of course, this is all within the context of what all of you are dealing with every day. In the context of the closing of the residential tenancy offices in Nanaimo and Vancouver, therefore, much less access for tenants in terms of enforcing their rights. And we're seeing tenants just saying, I can't get to Burnaby. I don't have the bus fare, can't take the time, I don't have the physical capacity to do it, whatever the reason. You know, especially seniors in the West End where the residential tenancy office used to be. Much bigger lineups and waits at the residential tenancy offices, much greater stresses on the staff that are there. Some concerns we have about incorrect information being given out, perhaps as a result of the increase in stress on the staff and the lack of training for new staff. Context of income assistance cuts in the 3-week waiting period. I mean, like all of you, we're now getting tenants who are phoning the hotline, not asking about their rights, but where they get the number for the nearest shelter so they can get there with their kids. The cuts to legal aid with the lack of poverty law services for tenants now, again, means that there's much less access to justice for tenants because they just don't have the support that they used to have with the legal services staff. So all of this is happening in a context.
I have a couple of questions about pets. I was of the understanding, and I could be wrong on this, that the right to have pets is somewhere in common law. And the other thing is, if you move in without pets and then suddenly acquire pets, then what happens to the landlord come along and say, now I need another half month's rent for or a damaged pet deposit?
There's nowhere that I'm aware of that talks to someone's right to have a pet. What the existing Act is silent on whether or not, it's just silent on the issue of pets. And so what there were court decisions saying that a landlord could not put in place a no pet clause because it was too broad. It didn't differentiate between a gerbil and a giraffe. So it couldn't be fairly applied. So you found that tenants who were in those situations in some cases were able to successfully dispute those clauses. But tenants with pets are very vulnerable if they have a clause that very in their tenancy agreement and they've signed it and it says no dogs, no cats. If they've agreed to that and then they go and get a pet, they're very vulnerable to being evicted. That hasn't changed under this act. In fact, the way we read this act, a landlord might be able to have a no pet clause and just get away with that. What has changed is that tenants with pets now will be charged a half month's rent. Now this, again, a landlord cannot go back, so an existing tenant or an existing agreement where a tenant's allowed to have a pet and the landlord has not been able to collect a deposit, they won't now retroactively be able to go back and collect a deposit. But I think what we'll see is that any tenants with pets entering into new tenancy agreements will pretty much automatically be charged a half month's deposit. And of course our concern is that because the landlord is still holding the security deposit, one of the things in our brief was to put in place the third party security deposit trust fund. And to be quite honest, we almost put it in there as a bit of a lark, because if we couldn't get it under the previous government, it wasn't too likely we were going to get it under this government. But the whole principle behind that was to take the money out of the landlord's pocket, to have it there if the landlord has a legitimate claim, because there are times when they have legitimate claims, but to make it more fair so that the landlord could get it back at the end of the tenancy, because what happens now is the landlord holds on to it whether or not they have a legitimate claim. And we're concerned that tenants with pets will end up being vulnerable to losing a full month's rent. Now, the doubling of the deposit if the landlord doesn't go through the process may be some incentive for landlords to not circumvent the process, because they could get hit with a lot more money. And maybe, especially if you're a pet owner, let's say your rent's $700, a landlord could be facing a $1,400 bill if they don't go through the process. So we'll see. That might be a small improvement around this stuff.
Any other questions?
Anything? Oh, Sadia's just going to ask.
One thing that we didn't get into is now apparently residential tenancy agreement must be in writing. But one thing that I'm concerned about is education, and many of us and many of the people I deal with who speak English as a second language, they don't have a concept of written tenancy agreements. And right now in the new act, there are new clauses there that allow landlords to put a clause in a tenancy agreement in which they can state the number of occupants. And if the tenant brings in a new person to move in, they can charge more money. All that will have to be decided. And also, my other concern is a lot of people act on assumptions, and I hear a lot on the hotline, and they assume that there is a stove, there is a fridge, there is a phone jack. And right now, if you rent a place and for some reason you don't read the agreement and just sign it, you may be signing something that says that no fridge, no stove, and no phone jack will be provided, and then you'll have a problem there because you will have to find the money to go and buy a stove or a fridge.
Did you want to add anything to that?
No.
So I think we're just going to wrap up because we all want to learn about human rights, but we'll do our best to... we'll do our best to keep you all informed. We've got information on our website, so if you don't know our website, it's www.tenants.bc.ca. But we'll also try and be in touch, and if you have any questions, please call us. Of course, in addition to trying to influence the government around some of these regulations, we have a huge job in front of us in terms of revamping all of our education and training materials. Our tenant survival guide, our fact sheets, our advocacy training, and of course, like all of you, we face budget cuts as well. So we've got a bit of a huge job in front of us. So that's another thing. The tenant survival guide is still available, and of course, it still completely applies. But if they do start to put things into force piece by piece, what I think we might have to do is do alerts and that kind of stuff. So please keep in touch with us. If you're not sure, please call us, because as I said, we'll do our best to get in touch with you. But if you haven't heard from us for a while, please call us if you're not sure about what's going on.
Most certainly we'll put these alerts also on the PovNet, because most of you probably are in PovNet.
And I think the other thing that we're going to need to do, we haven't really had a chance to sit down and talk about this yet, but I think we'll need to do some advocacy training, some extended ones in the new year. So we'll be doing our best to offer those, and we're going to need to go out and find some funds to see if it's possible to even do it around the province. But at this point, we don't have that, but we'll do our best to ensure that you have the information you need to advise tenants in your communities. So thank you for your time today. Thank you.